Yeah, keep listening.
Welcome to Screen Therapy. I'm your host, Jason Schurz. In October of 2018, I found myself in the hospital, sitting across from a psychiatrist who was telling me I had bipolar. I was sent home with a bunch of medication and laid on the couch for a week. I had my iTunes library on shuffle, trying to shake the hornet's nest from my head. Ever since I was a kid, I've been using loud music as a form of therapy. Punk rock and mental health have always been connected. This podcast looks at that connection through the lens of different guests. This is Screen Therapy. Mental health conditions present themselves in different people in different ways. If someone is experiencing symptoms of, say, depression, comorbid conditions could also be at play. Valerie Knox, guitarist of the Anti-Queens, spent most of her life dealing with anxiety and depression, but there was always something else. Restlessness, lack of focus, a busy, busy mind, with seemingly no reprieve. One day, her doctor presented attention deficit hyperactivity as an explanation for some of her symptoms, and the informal diagnosis fit. Valerie began to research the lack of treatment for girls in the 90s, a time when the gender binary perpetuated a lot of stereotypes. While boys were being diagnosed left and right because of their hyperactive behavior, girls were more likely to constantly daydream and be labeled gifted, showing a form of intelligence that the education system couldn't understand. With playing punk rock to validate her creativity and otherness, Valerie has found treatment, and in the midst of maximum volume, a quiet she never knew before.
My name is Valerie Knox. I play guitar in the Anti-Queens. I play in another band called Black Cat Attack. I've been playing in bands since 2004. I joined my first band. It's funny, I got suspended from high school and my mom got really mad at me. So my dad, to cheer me up, took me to a grand reopening of one of our music stores where I met my first band members. And I've been playing punk rock in local bands ever since. I haven't stopped. So 20 years. I got into punk rock specifically in high school. Consider myself a late bloomer in that sense, because before that, it's just a normal kid, liking the boy bands, liking animals, liking playing games and riding bikes. I got my first guitar, I think grade 9. My dad showed me your basic chords. E, A, D, G, F, and then showed me, oh, and C, and then showed me power chords. And power chords, that's where the fun started, because it was around the same time I was introduced to punk rock. You know, you get to high school and you meet all kinds of new people with new experiences and new opinions and outlooks. And that's where I found punk rock. And I had this nifty little tool called Napster. And I would just download some bands I'd overhear some of my friends talk about. And once I learned power chords, I started playing along to them. And then from there, I started finding more bands, started learning more songs, went to that grand reopening of that store and met my first band. And I didn't look back. That was it. there was just something with punk rock that really resonated with me. And I think it was the rebellion, and it was being different, because even as like a normal kid, I always felt different, and I always felt like I was different, but not in like a cool, like, I'm so different than everybody, I'm so cool. Like, it wasn't like that. It was like, I'm an outcast, I'm not cool. And punk rock is where I found like a sense of community and acceptance for sure.
Tell me a little bit about your mental health journey through the years. You talked about normal. A lot of folks with mental health conditions are pegged as being abnormal, which is silly, but wondering what your journey looks like from when you were younger.
There were a lot of really dark times. There was a lot of self-confidence issues. I grew up as a kid in the 90s and the early 2000s, and all our TV shows, all our movie stars, all our musicians, they were all these beautiful, skinny women and, you know, fashion. And we didn't have money to keep up with trends. So I think that kind of played a role into me feeling like an outcast, because, you know, kids were wearing Gap sweaters and I got my sister's hand-me-downs, essentially. Yeah, mental health. It was depression. It was, you know, feeling like there's a dark cloud over you and not being able to understand why or where it's coming from, what's causing it. It's weird because I remember this one day in high school where I don't know what it was. It was just like a really good day. I think maybe I got like a really good amount of sleep and I was just really happy all day. And I still think about that sometimes, because those days are so rare where you have an entire day and you just feel really good. There's no confidence issues. There's no doubts. There's no dark cloud. And you just are able to take on the day as it comes and there's no issues. Those days rarely ever happen. But I remember I had one in high school, and I feel like that was a moment where I thought, oh, this is what it's like to feel like a normal person, essentially. You know, it's interesting, though, that word normal, the scope of mental health and how many people it really does affect, especially now that we have such access to communication and talking to each other and connecting with more people through the internet, we are realizing just how normal it actually is to have mental health issues. And I feel like that also was something that helped me kind of accept it. I've always tried to be aware of it once I realized it's not a good thing to self-harm. It's not a good thing that you feel like you need to self-medicate. These are things that I have experienced in my life. And yeah, I try to stay away from that. And when I just trying to be aware of it, but depression was a really big one that just stayed with me from a teenager all the way to present day. To quote Dexter, my own dark passenger, you know.
I do volunteer work with a crisis line for youth. And a lot of times on these chats, they're very sad. They can deal with suicidal ideation and self-harm. And they come in a really desperate situation, obviously. Depression is a mental health condition. It's not just sad. It's not just feeling like you want to end it. It's not just feeling like you want to run away. When you were younger, did you ever get a sense of depression as being a clinical thing?
Yes. My mom tried to understand. She didn't, but she tried to understand. She tried to get me into therapy, and I just wasn't ready for it. And I wasn't ready to face it or accept it or acknowledge it even. I think I was just trying to be my own person the way I was. Kind of blame punk rock for that one. It's a rebellious stubbornness that comes with it. Clinical, I was never really treated for it. I didn't know how to talk to my doctor about it. And even 20 years ago, there's still stigma around it, right? It's a big problem and you are troubled and you're not good and you're not well and you need to be treated. And my attitude was always like, I am who I am and I'm just going to do the best I can. And I don't want any kind of medical intervention because I don't want to be a shell of myself. And I was always afraid of medications and how they would affect me because, again, I didn't really have the access to information on knowledge on it. I didn't have a doctor that was taking me seriously, especially as a teenager. And I didn't have really anyone outside of my friend group to talk to about it. And even then, most of them all had their own problems. There are a lot of us had mental health issues. A lot of us have grown out of it or gotten past it. Me, not so much, but I manage it. later in life, I started learning about ADHD, and it was fascinating because I had never really even considered that being something that I could have. I didn't feel like my attention was that out of control to really qualify. But then I started learning about it, and it actually shows up different in women than it does in men, and different in girls than it does in boys. And once I started learning more about it, I started piecing a bunch of things together. And it turns out there's a ton of instances in my life that add up to that. So I started talking to my current doctor about it, and don't have the funds to go through with testing and all of that, but I am being treated as if I have it, just because I did the basic paper test that you do just get started. And my doctor was convinced, based on everything I was saying and showing all the research I was doing, and I'm an adult and I have a pretty good sense of self. I like to think I do.
I did the same checklist, and it was weird because I live with bipolar as well. So parsing it out, what's this and what's that? But taking that checklist and seeing that I got 10 out of 10.
Yeah.
Okay, well, maybe this is something, but my psychiatrist said, definitely this is what you're dealing with on top of comorbidity of bipolar. You talked before about the kids in school, and they all has issues going on. Medicating in, let's call them, unhealthy ways, such as the substance use or self-harming versus treatment. And obviously you had music. That was maybe the healthy medication.
Absolutely.
Especially getting into punk rock, which has a very I can do this ethos to it.
Well, I felt validated. I felt validated as a person, and I felt validated in my experiences and how I was handling them. Again, punk rock is such a sense of rebellion, but also community. So to hear bands singing about it, we had Blink-182's Adam song. That was such a big song back in the day. And it was one of the first times that for myself and my generation, a band mainstream singing about these topics. And then, you know, more bands started doing it. Good Charlotte put one out, I think, and bands were talking about it. And I thought, oh, okay, so it's not just me, and it's totally normal and regular for people to experience these things and to go through this. And so that's where the validation kind of came from. And when these bands were putting these songs out and talking about it, I never looked at it as like a glorification of it, but more so just some visibility. It was good to feel seen.
So gender and ADHD, I haven't done much reading on that myself. What did you find out?
So it turns out in the 90s, and I remember this, it was very popular to talk about ADD in kids and boys specifically. It was always boys. And it was always boys that were being diagnosed because they presented in such an obvious way. You know, they were moving around. They couldn't sit still. They're interrupting and they're fidgeting and they're go, 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 go all the time. They're bouncing off the walls. And it turns out years later, after more research and more studies, it was always there in female persons too. It just presented itself different. So with young girls, they weren't bouncing off the walls, but they were sitting there daydreaming, which I did all the time. And it would present itself in being able to understand certain things. And I was tested for being gifted in elementary school. I was taken out of my classes with three other students, two boys and one other girl. And this went on for a couple months, I think, in grade 6 or grade 7. And then, you know, suddenly I was being put into leadership camp. There's personality differences. There's intelligence differences. It just presents itself totally different. And the more I learned about it, I'm like, this is sounding a lot like my experience as a child. And then going into teenage years, it can show itself as depression. And it turns out that it can be a comorbidity. Depression, anxiety can go with ADHD, especially if untreated. Because you have things going on in your brain that you don't understand why it's working that way. And I could never understand why I was feeling these things because I had, in my sense, no reason to be unhappy. I grew up in a loving home, a broken home, but still, like, my parents' divorce didn't affect me the way, you know, some people can be affected. It was more like my sister and I both were just like, this makes sense. This works. This is better. And it was my brain, too. It was hard to focus in school, especially when people told me to do things. I don't like being told to do anything. I don't like being ordered around. And it's not because I'm just a brat. It's just a personality thing. It's just something that happens in my brain. You tell me to do something, I'm going to be like, no. So every time my mom told me to do my homework, I would just sit up there and doodle and I would draw and I would do things that were entertaining to me. And I thought it was rebellion. And it turns out it was just my brain being unmedicated. I wasn't able to concentrate on certain things. It was hard to study. It was so hard to study, to sit still. It's so hard to sit and make myself do something I wasn't interested in. I don't know what it was. I never considered myself dumb, but I felt like I don't want to do this. Maybe I am dumb. You know, maybe I don't get it. And it's not that I didn't get it. I enjoy learning things, but I just have this weird problem where I want to do things the way I want to do it. It was hard for me to get through school if someone's not encouraging me and working with me and just treating me like a peasant that has to do the thing so they can collect their paycheck. And good teachers are hard to come by. We had a teacher that would just like, they'd put up the note and then they would talk through it. So I'm not taking anything in because my brain doesn't work that way. And we didn't know.
So finding treatment later in life, and sounds like there's been a huge improvement since those days. But at the same time, I'm sure you know this, I live with it every day, but it's really hard to stay on top of it, to keep an even keel, to have days where I just feel out of control.
Yep, I still have those days.
What does it look like now? It's obviously a lot more stable, but how do you manage it?
So about a year ago, I started taking stimulants for my brain, very low dose, just because I didn't have the proper diagnosis. I'll never forget it. The first day I took it, I work in a music store, and where I work, I have an office. I do half and half, half on the sales floor, half in an office. And my office is around the corner from where we do speaker rentals. So they're testing speakers all day. And then after a certain period in the afternoon, there's a music lessons center on the second floor. And right on top of my office is where they do drums. So I'll never forget the first day I went to work on my medication. And I remember walking into my office and just thinking, wow, it is so quiet in here. Wow. I couldn't believe it. It blew me away. That doesn't happen anymore. I barely even notice it. I'm just able to focus and do the work that I need to do. And I don't get distracted nearly as much, because when you are a person with a what I like to call a spicy brain, if you're focused on something, you get interrupted, that is devastation. It is dramatic and devastating, and it becomes more frustrating. And I think this is kind of where depression and anxiety kind of tie in, because if you are unaware of what's causing this, you're going to get more frustrated, you're going to get more anxious, and then you're just going to get so frustrated that you just start getting sad and you start giving up and you start feeling like there's no hope. And I've been down that hole many times, but my doctor and I, after a few months of trying stuff and then reconvening and talking about it and seeing how it's working, how it's what's good and what's bad, I've definitely noticed a huge improvement in my mood, my time management, my ability to stay focused on tasks, even if they're not the most interesting, because I'm a person that wants to get the job done right. It's just been a struggle my whole life, but the medication's absolutely helping now for sure.
One of the podcast episodes of Scream Therapy recently, I talked to Chris Broach, who's a guitar player of Braid, and he also lives with ADHD. And he was talking about how this idea of body doubling.
Yep.
You have to have someone around you, otherwise you're going to forget things and leave things in weird places. And I was thinking about when my partner's away, I just basically wander in circles and don't remember what I was doing. I leave the door open, I leave the stove on. It's just a bit of a nightmare. So, kind of interesting concept, and I hadn't really thought about it before.
For me, body doubling is where it helps me, my partner. Sometimes I get him to just come hang out with me while I'm doing the dishes. I don't need his help. I just want him there, you know? And that helps me be comfortable in doing this mundane task I don't want to do. Otherwise, I'm going to resist and I'm going to hate it. And I'm just going to throw my hands up and, like, that's enough, whatever. But if someone's there talking to me and distracting me from what I'm doing, the thing that I don't want to do, it helps me do it. Body doubling is absolutely a thing that I never really utilized in the past because I didn't know anything about it. And that, again, it's the thing with girls in the 90s, they were overlooked because they didn't present the way that boys were. So there's tons of boys that received treatment and medication because they were showing signs of this. They were showing the symptoms. They were showing the behaviors that ADD was connected with. But there wasn't a ton of research at the time. It was relatively new in terms of really picking it out in kids. In 90s is, I believe, where it really started to become more prevalent and more aware. But girls were overlooked. We're learning up things about ourselves that we should have learned about 20, 30 years ago, but we were overlooked because they didn't know what the symptoms in girls were. They just assumed it would be the same, and it's not. It's not at all.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And this idea that you have to see it to believe it,
Yeah.
and all this stuff that's going on internally isn't seen, and therefore, how do you diagnose somebody? In some ways, that's, I think, why a lot of people slip through the cracks, is because until they become physically demonstrating these symptoms, it's kind of, you have to go past that point of no return in some cases. As soon as someone's unhoused and using and yelling at the top of their lungs on the street or whatever, then okay, now we know something's going on. But all the hidden stuff, it kind of wells up. And for a lot of people, I think it just kind of explodes once it gets to a certain point.
And that's exactly what happened with me. Especially during the pandemic, it was such a trying time for me. My personal happiness relies on playing music, playing punk rock, being around large groups of people, being on the road, going to different places, traveling to other countries. This has all been part of it for like 10 years of my career. And it was just all suddenly taken away. And I definitely got through it, but I had to find outlets to do this. So I was able to start talking to my doctor about it.
So how does ADHD affect your guitar playing? Because that's something you've been doing for.
20 years, over 20 years.
Does it correlate between being hyper-focused? Do you lose attention as you're trying to do it? Like, where do we fall with that?
See, here's the thing. Most of my career, I was unaware of this, unaware. So I just had to cope and manage the way I thought that it was going to work for me. So sometimes it would take me longer to get the hand-eye coordination for certain guitar parts, but I don't think it really had a huge influence, negative or positive, only because this was just something that I've always felt in my heart was what I was supposed to be doing. So I've always just kind of trusted my instincts and followed them, and I play guitar the way I play guitar, and I don't think it's really hindered me at all in that sense.
You're very open about mental health, and that's a very special thing. I think it's hard to be open about it,
It is.
especially hard to be open about it if you're a public person who's in a band and plays lots of shows and has a lot of fans. And I'm wondering what you think it is about you that allows you to be open about
You know what? I'm gonna fully blame punk rock for this.
it.
Because the older I get, the less I care about anybody else, and the more I care about people who care. So I've been very open about how I feel and what it feels like to feel how I feel sometimes. And I try to describe it. And I try to just say, hey, you know, it's okay to talk about it. And I find even that's an outlet is just talking about it. And I hope that for all the people that think, oh, whatever they want to think about me. Maybe there's a couple of people that maybe are encouraged to talk to someone. I personally can't be there for all the people, but hopefully they are encouraged to talk to people they trust. whether it be a family member or a friend or a teacher, a guidance counselor, the number one thing is to always trust your instincts. And my instincts always tell me to be honest and open about how I'm feeling, especially when I feel like I'm reaching one of those moments where you need an output to get it out. Normally, my outlet is on stage. The band is my outlet. Performing, touring, playing my guitar, all of these things allow me to mentally reset every time I get to do it.
That was my conversation with Valerie Knox of the Antiqueens, antiqueens.com. For more episodes of Screen Therapy, go to screentherapyhq.com or wherever you listen to podcasts. Big news, the Screen Therapy book is available now. Screen Therapy, A Punk Journey Through Mental Health, tells my story and the stories of others who use punk as a catalyst for mental health. Like this podcast, it links the community-minded punk scene with the mental wellness of the punks who belong to it. To order the book, go to screentherapyhq.com. For merch, check out the newly opened store at screentherapyhq.com/store. And for even more designs, check out Scream Therapy on TeePublic. Okay, enough promoting. It's time for some thanking. Thank you for listening to Scream Therapy. Doing this podcast and talking to folks about punk rock and mental health has been a crucial part of my own mental stability, and it means so much to me that you're out there listening. Screen Therapy is created in the Cathet region of coastal British Columbia, Canada, on the traditional territory of the Klahaman Nation. Contact me at screentherapyhq.com or email me at screentherapypodcast@gmail.com. I'd love to hear from you. Let's talk about punk rock and mental health. Until next time, take care and be well.
Explores 1990s indie classics, recently exhumed underground gems, every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time and 9 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time. Tune in if you're a slacker, loser, or creep for an hour of positively nostalgic triggers and some new stuff too. On CJSF 90.1 FM or streaming at cjsf.ca.
stay tuned for